Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts through the lens of a Kenpo practitioner. And as always, I am Reggie Darden, and I have another wonderful guest with me. This is Rebecca Knight here, and I'm excited to get to chat with her and learn her story and just kind of whatever other items that we get into. I usually start things off with just giving a little brief background on me. I currently train in 5 different martial arts at this point. Kenpo being one of the primary ones. I also train in capoeira, train in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, and Hapkido. I also have some experience in taekwondo and boxing, and that's needless to say, I'm pretty busy with a job and dogs and a podcast. I have a lot to do, but I just enjoy chatting with not only Kenpoists, but other martial artists about their stories. I love getting the stories and love to be able to share with them. So I will continue to try and find time to do that and kind of go from there. So I will go ahead and turn it over to our guest here. How did Kenpo find you? How did the martial arts find you? And where did it all begin? And we'll just go from there.
Wonderful. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm very, very honored to be on this podcast. You've had my mentors on this podcast recently, John Sepulveda, and you've had one of my students on this podcast, Michelle Higgins, friend. And she's a wonderful lady. So I'm really, really grateful to be following in their footsteps and be able to share my story along with theirs.
You're very nice. I, of course, enjoyed speaking with both of them, and we'll definitely do follow-ups in the future. So I like it.
Wonderful. How I found the martial arts. Everyone comes to martial arts for different reasons. And I've been teaching for a while, running a school for a while. And I find there's generally, they fit into about a category of 3 or 4 different reasons people come in. Sometimes they're walking in the door because they're just looking for community. They want a place where they belong. Martial arts just is one of the ways that they can find that community through like-minded people. Sometimes they walk in the door because they're looking for competition. They're looking to challenge themselves against other people, see how they measure up and push themselves a little farther. Sometimes they're walking through the doors. They just want something to express themselves with. It's an art form. It's a way to just, where can I put my energy and my passion? And sometimes they walk through that door because they're afraid. Something terrible has happened to them. And if there's something they can do about it to make sure it doesn't happen again, that's why they're there. And that final reason is the reason why I walked through the door. I was born and raised in a religious cult. The first 10 years of my life were spent communal living. There was mental, physical, and sexual abuse, which was pretty much on a regular basis, whether it was perpetuated on myself or my siblings, of which I had 7. So the first 10 years of my life, there was no hope. There was no ability to defend myself verbally or physically. And there was really no other option other than to be a victim of my circumstances. We moved to the States because this cult was primarily in Mexico. We moved to the States when I was about 10. And the process of figuring out what life was supposed to be like outside of that really got started. We were agoraphobic, all of us, afraid to leave the house, afraid to venture out. And some of the small things that we started to do to find ourselves led to bigger things. I started first with music. I didn't feel as a child. I was not allowed to feel. I felt what others around me told me to feel. And so sourcing my feelings was difficult, if not impossible. I'll be honest, to this day, it's still something I work on, but I have tools in hand now. And music was the first thing I went to, and it started to unlock some of those doors and allow me to feel. So it gave me an avenue to find what I was feeling, but not a full way to express it. I did that for a couple years, and my older sister started in the martial arts first. And she was changing. She was becoming more confident. I could see there were things about her that she was gaining that I wanted to have. And after a year of her going to classes and me occasionally stopping in and watching and really being terrified about the idea of doing anything physical, being terrified of everything, including martial arts, it took me that entire year of watching her do what she did to go, I need to get myself out there and get out on the mats. And class number one did it. I had my bio recently read. I did a symposium with Barbara Wyda about a month ago. It was a domestic violence awareness symposium. And she read my bio and it says, in my first lesson, I felt something I hadn't felt before. A small sense of confidence, that little bit of self-worth. And I go, ooh, I want more of this. And that was 29 years ago on August 29th of this year was my very first Kempo lesson. And honestly, I couldn't imagine my life without the martial arts, because that started me on the journey to finding myself, starting the healing process. And I say starting because it's ongoing, but really being able to pass along to others the skills that I have gained, so that, because I was a victim when I was a child, and I see these kids come in that are struggling, whether it's confidence, whether it's bullies, whatever it is, I can help them overcome it while it's still small. I can help them battle it while it's right in front of them, and they don't have to wait till they're older. They don't have to wait to heal. They can start that process now, and they can negate some of those things from happening.
Oh, I love the love at first sight, first kick, first punch.
Yes.
When I started, I mean, I've always been interested in the martial arts, and when I finally got that opportunity to start training, I mean, just as soon as I walked into the smelly studio with the shag carpet, and I was just in love from the start. So I always enjoy that. It's interesting that your stories has some elements that are kind of similar to elements in my life. One being, well, my sister-in-law was part of a kind of cult militia situation, and kind of a lot of the same things happen in her life as far as just being sheltered from the world and not being able to get out and experience things, and having that fear of you know, other things, other people. So there's a little similarity to that, and it's just like, oh, what? Like it's kind of crazy to think that there's these groups and things out there that really can affect you and just really kind of change that trajectory of your life. The other thing that I always find funny is that there is a lot of my guests, it's someone else that was doing the art, and then the guest is like, oh, well, you know, I went to one class, or I just kind of, you know, tagged along or something. And then usually the person that brought them stops training, and then the guest continues on, and then not only continues on, but then that becomes like a huge, huge, huge part of their life. So I always find that interesting, coming from the side that I've always just been like, oh, I can't wait to do this. I got to do this. And a lot of times it's like, oh, I wasn't even interested in it. And then it just becomes that passion. So, I'm curious. So what was the catalyst for your sister joining?
You know, I have to assume it was the same thing. She grew up in the same environment that I did. She was older, so some of her experiences might have been different than mine, maybe in some ways more challenging than mine, because I was younger when we came out. But I believe she was looking for the exact same things that I was looking for. She was looking for community. She was looking for confidence. And it wasn't just any karate school that would have done it for me. I found the right place at the right time. The instructor that was there, his name is Jace Waite, and he was kind, he was compassionate, he wasn't the typical Cobra Kai that would have not have done it for me. I would have walked in day one and walked right back out and never gone back. But he cared how I felt, and he cared to empower me, not just to control the environment of the karate school and make me do what everyone else was doing. And it was his compassion that allowed me to be the student I needed to be in the moment, which was very timid, very shy. I would not yell. I would not ki. And as you all know, that's part of the martial arts. We make sound effects. There's reasons for it. It tightens the body, prepares for impact, you know, gets your voice out there, lets the opponent know you mean business, lets people know you're in a fight, that, you know, maybe you need help. I know all those reasons. But in the moment, I couldn't overcome any of those because I was afraid. And I was afraid by making myself be focused on in any way, shape, or form, I would make myself the victim. So it was like I had this reverse psychology I was kind of dealing with along the way. And he would always ask me, the next belt promotion, are you going to ki? And I would go, okay, I'm going to try. And then I wouldn't. And he'd go, well, what's your favorite color? Finally, my purple belt. We had it out. I needed to start doing this already. But he never gave up on me. And he never got frustrated with me. And he always listened. And I'll be honest, I emulate him with my students all the time. Because I have people that come in with a lot of those same struggles. And I get to go, hey, somebody took care of me. And I'm going to pass that along and make sure I have that perspective and take care of them. And realize why they're struggling, not just address that struggle and go, why can't they rise to the occasion? There's a lot of things behind the scenes. Especially when you're dealing with victims or people that have survived bad situations, there'll be reasons why they won't participate. There'll be reasons why they can't do certain things. And it's not just that they're being defiant, it's because they're struggling. And he was able to see that it was struggle, not defiance, and help me past it. And that was an amazing tool that I passed along, but it was also, I don't think anyone else in that moment could have given me what I needed and given me the opportunity that Jace Waite did.
Very nice. Yeah, the instructor, the school, it makes all the difference. And there's so many, there's a lot of schools out there that even though it's not exactly the most lucrative business to get into, there's a lot of schools out there that are just there for the student tuition. And you know, they kind of are interested in the martial arts, but it's not really their passion. Or mm-hmm. or they just want to get as many black belts as they can and not really interested in really connecting with the students and not just teaching them the stuff off the book, but also giving them those other life skills and giving them the confidence and the motivation and all of those Mr. Miyagi type principles that we're getting kind of away from with a lot of this MMA, and you know, not knocking MMA or anything like that, but it's less about the mental and the emotional and the spiritual, and just more about, oh well, how many elbows can I put into this orbital socket today. And so I like that. You had that teacher to really, you know, help build you up. And so coming up, where did you kind of start falling into the training easily, or were there still kind of stumbling blocks coming up?
You know, the martial arts journey for me was incredibly hard because I had to overcome so much just to show up. I would have panic attacks on the regular. I'd be in the middle of class and I would get red splotches from head to toe. I would be burning up and I would just have to leave the area because I was outside of my comfort zone. Whether it was being put on the spot to have to speak publicly was really, really hard for me, or speak in front of the other students, or just to physically have to perform a move. It just, none of it was easy. But because it wasn't easy, and because it was challenging, and because I was able to overcome it, it became more empowering than anything else I had in my life. So it was always hard. And coming up in the martial arts, it always hasn't been friendly for women. So it was always more challenging to come up as a female. People would, you know, especially with any level of rank, they wanted to see if you really did have it, or if there was a reason why, an alternate reason why you got your rank. My current instructor is my husband. It's how we met. You know, it's a standard Kenpo love story. He was such an amazing teacher. We ended up getting married. We just celebrated 22 years in September.
Yeah, congratulations.
And part of that journey, I came to him as a second degree black belt because I had taken a little bit of time off and then came back into the art. And in that process of being his wife and his student, he has always made sure that I earned every single rank that I wear, because the last thing he wants is someone to go, oh, she's his wife, so that's why she's a seventh degree. And he's like, nope, he put her out on the mats with anyone and she's going to have to prove it for herself, you know. So he's always made it a little bit more challenging for that reason. And I am grateful for him for that. And I wouldn't have it any other way. So the challenges that I've come across have been more mental and emotional. I've told the story recently, but it's powerful, so I'd like to share it again. I've had amazing coaches. Mr. Waite was my first teacher, and he taught me for a little bit under a year, and then the school changed hands, and as life happens, things shift and change. I had a couple other people that stepped in, and then my husband has been my instructor since 2002. But in 2006, we met Seegung Stephen LeBounding, and he became a mentor and a coach to both of us, and an amazing man. We lost him in 2020, but every lesson that we had with him was just pure gold. He taught us to respect ourselves. He taught us to stand up for ourselves. He taught us that martial arts was just an extension of that. It was the physical extension of the power that he wanted us to have within ourselves. And a lot of that he was able to express because of his background. He was a police officer in Sacramento, and he worked in his unit in sex crimes against women and children. And so he watched people that went through these situations. He watched people that overcame them. He watched people that went back to those situations and were re-victimized. So he knew what that fear was that they were facing. And my husband and I have very similar upbringings. He didn't grow up in a cult, but he grew up in a drug house. And he grew up with a lot of bad stepfathers that were abusive. And so we had a lot of the same struggles in our martial arts. So the story that I'm leading up to and all that backstory is for is several years ago, I want to say about 10 years ago, we were doing a seminar in our school, and Seegung came down for a lot of events. We loved every chance we had to have him influence our students. And he was running a drill where I was on my back and he was coming, standing over me. And he was talking about, you know, working angles and what to do in that situation. And as he was leaning down over me in that class, he saw fear in my eyes. And in that moment, he shifted gears. We did something different in the seminar. Everything worked out well, but he asked to speak with me privately afterwards. And he called me Miss Rebecca. That's the way that he loved me. And he said, Miss Rebecca, I need to apologize to you. He goes, I saw something in your eyes I never want to see again. I saw fear. And I'm never going to partner with you in that drill. I'm never going to put you in that position. I'm going to save you from that. I'm sorry, and it's never going to happen again. And I thought about it for a second, and I said, Seegung, don't do that to me. Please don't take away the opportunity for me to be afraid in an environment I still know is safe and overcome it. Because if I can't overcome it here, I can't overcome it anywhere. So I begged him, let me be your partner. Challenge me. Push me. Know I'm going to be afraid, but know I'm going to show up anyway. And because I did, I'm going to know that that's possible. So it was, I accept the challenges. I almost embrace and encourage the challenges that come in the martial arts, because every challenge that I do embrace and see and approach makes me better. It gives me an opportunity. So I'm still learning and growing along the way. And those challenges are different every time. That sometimes it's a tournament and putting yourself out there in front of other people. Sometimes it's just those little situations where you're terrified in the moment and you still have to overcome it. And to me, those are the joys in life that I get to encounter along the way and see how I can rise to the occasion as it happens.
Oh, I love that. I love that drive to continue and to be pushed. Sorry, current generation, younger generations, but there's a lot of not that grit, that intestinal fortitude, that drive to push yourself. Things are going to be uncomfortable, especially in the martial arts. It's like you're training. Well, okay, not everyone is training to be a warrior, so to speak, but it is a combat art, and yeah, there's going to be tough moments. And if you run into that and then you're just like, okay, I'm going to just shut down, that doesn't help. So, I like that push. Kind of going back a little bit, and this will kind of connect to the next little piece I wanted to ask about, but I wanted to make sure I get to this is that dealing with, you know, the anxiety and having the panic attacks and just, you know, the, I guess for lack of a better term, just kind of that fear of the different things, the training, whatnot. What kind of things would you give as advice for others that may be kind of struggling in that, and not only just in the kind of martial arts training, but maybe just in life, how would you suggest to deal with those sorts of things?
It's a great question. One of the biggest things that helped me is put it into perspective. Everything, fear is a mile wide, but an inch deep. So if you put it into perspective and you go, what am I really dealing with? And Sigung would tell us all the time, he goes, when I would lament about something or something was frustrating me or stressing me out, he goes, does it affect the way you breathe? And if it does, then it matters. And let's do something about it. If not, take a deep breath and move on. And so in the moment when I'm dealing with that stress and that panic, and I'm like, does this really as big of a deal as I'm making it out to be? And if it's not, take a chill pill, calm down, move through it. And if it is, drive through it, push. And use, Sigung would always say this in the end of his seminars, and it's being echoed everywhere, and I love it. And it's the mentality of not me, not today. If something bad's going to happen, nope, not me, not today. I'm going to overcome this. You think you're going to take me out? Not me, not today. Emotionally, you think you're going to bully me and put me in my place and not allow me to have a voice? Not me, not today. So I have those two anchors of the empowerment of not me, not today. And then the perspective is, does this really matter? And if it does, address it directly. And if not, just move forward calmly.
Excellent, excellent. I like it. So let's connect that into the competing side of it. For myself, I grew up very, very shy, very just, you know, I don't want to be out there. And then also couple that with, I did not get the sports gene, the athletic gene. I have three older brothers, and they all did football and track and baseball and basketball and bowling. I mean, even my mother, like, they were pretty much on the path to being pro bowlers, which seems crazy to me.
Wow.
And so we had all kinds of trophies and stuff all over our house, and I had none because I was terrified to do anything. Somehow I was able to get into the Kenpo training, and I did do a handful of tournaments, and I got disqualified in every one of them. So
that was fun.
Well, I say this because I went to a lot of open tournaments, and in the open tournaments, for still baffles me that head contact, face contact, a lot of times was not allowed. And I'm a big fan of we called it the California Blitz, and so I was blitzing my way into them, and I like that back knuckle reverse punch combo, and
yes. So.
Yeah, I throw that back knuckle and they're like, oh, no head contact, no face contact. And I'm like, this is martial arts, right? Last time I checked, that's a part of the body that you should be able to hit. But so, yeah, I got disqualified in everyone. But I enjoyed going just to support my friends and whatnot. But so how did the competing side of that come into your life, and were you able to, how did you kind of overcome that that anxiety? Because I still get nervous thinking about tournaments I'm not even in.
Oh, I'm nervous just talking about tournaments. I totally understand. Yes. You know what? It's perspective. I competed quite a bit when I was lower ranking and kind of coming up in the previous organization we were part of. They were really big on tournaments. And I would have the same panic attacks and the same nerves and the same worries and the same things. I now see it more of as a challenge in the moment to kind of calm my breathing, get my state of mind in place. I hadn't competed in a very, very long time. And a couple years ago, I was 1 year out of ACL surgery and the internationals were going on and we were there for a symposium. And my husband goes, "We're not traveling out here and you're not going to compete. You know, if we're going to go, let's go big." And he talked me into competing. I didn't compete in sparring. I wanted to make sure that knee was still healing. I was a little tentative and nervous, but I opted to compete in forms. And kind of brushing the dust off after having not competed for maybe 10, 15 years or so was a little unnerving. I need to give a shout out. I have an amazing forms coach who's not just a forms coach. He's also coaching us in everything in life. His name is Lee Wedlake. We lovingly refer to him as Uncle Lethal. And he is a forms champion. He is amazing. He has other students. Joe Cantelli is a forms champion. And he had been coaching me on my forms for a little bit. So that really helped give me a little bit more confidence going out there, knowing I had the best of the best behind me. Confidence, but also a little bit of nerves because I had the best of the best behind me and I wanted to make him proud. And then I give a ton of credit to my husband who was there the whole time, you know, making sure I was breathing, making sure that I knew what I was doing as I was second guessing myself in the hotel room the night before. He's like, you know this form. You know you've been doing this form for like 20 something years. You got this. And just kind of nudging me in the right direction. But it's really getting out there and competing is the ultimate opportunity to show yourself what you're made of. And you either win or you learn. You either show up and do your best and you're like, yes, I did it. Or you fumble and you falter and you figure out why. Was your mindset not in place? Was your training regimen not in place? Did you just assume you could do form four and you hadn't really checked your cardio? You know, there's a lot of those things in place. And I did do form four and I did win grand champion. So I'm proud of that. And that was a great achievement. One of the really cool things was I also competed in weapons. And I did a staff set. It's Chuck Sullivan's staff set.
Oh, yes. One of my favorites.
I love that set. And back in the day, Seagung Lubowney did some training down in Chinatown. And it was kind of like a martial arts exchange. He would share what he knew. They would share what he knew, kind of a thing back and forth. And he showed them the staff set. And they had the tenacity to say, "You want us to fix that for you?" And Seagung did not take that well. Seagung rumbled and he grumbled, "What are you talking about?" And it wasn't the form, it was a transition. And he goes, "Let me show you some what we call palm frictions." And the palm frictions just transition the hands so you can get more rotation and power without binding up. Mm-hmm. And they also protect the elbow. You tuck the elbow on the inside of the staff versus the outside of the staff. And that's one of Seagung's signature pieces. So the really cool part about competing in that tournament was I was competing. There was a stage behind the judges, and guess who was standing on that stage? But Chuck Sullivan himself and my husband staring me down. And then I could see Gung up on high looking down going, "Put fire in the belly. You better hit. You better go hard. You better go fast. You better go strong." And that was an amazing experience. I did get first place in the form as well. So I hope I made everyone here and up in heaven a little bit proud.
Oh, I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did. That's excellent stuff. Like you said, that's one of my favorite form sets. I need to work on it myself. In the garage last few times that I was working on it, it was in my living room, and I have very high ceilings, but not everything. There are other items in my living room that probably should not be there when swinging around a staff. So
yes. Oh, I have a great story on this real quick.
Go ahead. We worked on
this with Seagung in his garage. In his house, we'd go visit him on Seagung Mountain once a year, and he'd come to us several times a year. But we were learning this in his garage, and we already knew the base form, and he was trying to show us the palm frictions and tucking the elbow and such. And he would teach with in his hand what he called Master Shinai, which was just a shinai. It makes a lot of noise. Yes, it hurts, and it gets your attention. And every time my elbow would pop outside the staff doing it the old way versus the new way, he would hit my husband with the shinai and say, tell your student to tuck her elbow. Well, it didn't take long for me to realize all I needed to do to get my husband hit was pop that elbow out. And man, did I take advantage of it.
Yeah, that'll do.
I paid for it later. In the moment, it was worth it.
Hey, sometimes you got to go for it. You got to take it while you have the opportunity. So.
I took the chance.
I like it. I like it. I like it. All right, so we're going to move over to the teaching side of things. When did you get involved in teaching? Was that something that you were always interested in, or did you, like many a guest, just fall into it or have it thrust upon you?
Well, a little bit thrust upon me, a little bit fall into it. I was given the opportunity when I was an orange belt to start teaching and assisting. And I didn't feel like it was the thing for me when I first got started. I was super tentative, super nervous, so unsure of myself. I'm like, I'm not adding value to these people's lessons. I felt like I was taking away from it. And it took me some time to kind of realize that martial arts is my passion, but teaching is really where it's at for me, because I get to see those aha moments in my students. So I've been a martial artist for 29 years. I've been teaching for 28 years. And I think that has been one of the most rewarding parts of my journey, because everything that I have been able to figure out for myself, I now get the opportunity to figure out how to pass that along to my students. And they all learn differently. They're all here for different reasons. They all pick up at different paces. I teach, my youngest student is 4. We teach a 4 to 6 year old program. My oldest student is 78. Nice. And so I get to kind of span the gambit between skill sets, awareness, attention span, you know, depth of what they can throw themselves into and such. And so it's been rewarding and it's been challenging. And I think my childhood and my past experiences have given me some tools to reach the students that are struggling, but it also really helps me to continue to empower the students that aren't here because of those same emotional struggles. But they still need to know that somebody cares about them, that somebody believes in them, and that they can be built up again beyond where they're currently at. So teaching, and to teach is to learn. You know, students will ask you questions you don't know the answer to. And I'll be really honest, if I have a really intelligent student, and we are so lucky, we have the highest caliber of students in our school. We have doctors, we have college professors, we have, you know, helicopter pilots, we have majors in the Army and in the Air Force. We have intelligent people that ask really intelligent questions. And when they ask me something I don't know, I tell them, honestly, I don't know, but guess what? We're both about to find out. And I know who to go ask. So the learning process continues. But just, you know, having the opportunity to teach martial arts for a living is probably one of the most rewarding things that I could have ever done. We make a good living doing what we do. Could I have made more doing other things? Likely, but the emotional paycheck to me matters as much, if not more, than the financial paycheck. We give scholarships to students that need it, because I was given a scholarship, and if I couldn't have, I would not have been able to continue. So it's a service to others, but in every opportunity that I have to teach and give to somebody or empower somebody else, I'll be honest, it fixes a little piece of me that's broken. So when I see a kid that gets it, or a kid that's empowered, or a kid that's no longer struggling, the little Rebecca inside me that didn't have that hope and didn't have that self-confidence, she gets fixed a little bit too. So it's a service-based art, but it's really self-serving. So I'm kind of selfish doing what I do, because I sure am passionate about it, but I get so much out of it. It makes me want to show up every single day and do it again.
Oh yeah. No, I can relate. I haven't had much experience opportunity to teach Kenpo, but I've taught Capoeira for a lot of years. And I love that aha moment when someone, when a student gets something or movement clicks or a principle or something clicks, and it's like, oh, that light goes on, and it's like, oh, I'm so glad I was part of making that happen. And so I love that feeling and that moment. And so it's always exciting to see that. So yeah, very nice. Is there something that in your teaching now that that maybe you wish you had when you started teaching, or maybe something that you did previously or was around previously that we don't do now that maybe you wish would come back, anything like that?
That's a really good question. And this is something that I've had to kind of come to terms with over the years. I've come through multiple styles of Kenpo. And the first system of Kenpo I came up in was not Ed Parker's Kenpo, it was Tracy's Kenpo. And I did that for a while until we came over to the Parker system. And for many, many, many years, I couldn't see the value in that. I saw that as a detriment because I had to unlearn a lot of what I had done previously to understand the way things that are done now. And I would be so jealous of what I would call homegrown Kenpoists who had an amazing Kenpo teacher from day one, same style, no differences. And they had this pristine upbringing in the foundation of the art. And I wanted to be them. And then I realized, a lot like my childhood, I didn't come up in that caring, nurturing, healthy environment. And all of that is wonderful and good. And I want people that have that to cherish it. But because I didn't, because I have a different perspective, I have depth that I can offer to the students. So because I've seen the way things were done previously, or because I had to unlearn something to learn something new, I can be a better guide and I can better understand my students that have cross-trained, or we have students that are black belts in other styles that came to train with us. And when they're going, man, I'm really having a struggle adjusting my foot because of my old style, the heel is here. But in this style, the heel goes out and I understand why. I can be more compassionate and I can give them some of the tools that I used to convert old habits that were bad into good habits, or change an old pattern into a better pattern. So I think as much as I would want to lament and say, I wish I had it the easy route in Kenpo, I don't think I'd want to say I wish I had it the easy route in life either, because I would lose all of the tools that I gained in that struggle along the way. So having the teachers that I had in the times that I had them was exactly what I needed. And now I'm incredibly lucky. We had what we call the Four Horsemen of American Kenpo as our coaches: Seegung Stephen LeBounty, rest in peace, Bob White, rest in peace, John Sepulveda, who also has a nickname, the Sepulvenator. If we love you, you get a nickname. Like, there's no getting out of it.
I like that.
And, yes. And then Lee Wedlake, Uncle Lethal. And those four gentlemen had coached us in life. They had coached us in the martial arts. They have coached us in business. And they have helped us whenever we have a position where we're not really sure what to do. We've gone to them, and their advice has been absolutely amazing in pointing us in the right direction. And even when we've seen their advice and hesitated to take it, the second we did, we understood where they were coming from and why they were telling us what to do.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. So like you, I started in essentially a Tracy's system. And then when I switched over to the Ed Parker's curriculum, the first school I made it, I got about halfway through my green belt. And when I switched to the school that I'm at now, let me go back a little bit. I didn't realize that there were different styles of Kenpo when I first started training. And kind of rat hole tangent, but I always laugh when I watch The Perfect Weapon, because like I didn't know about the putting the belt knot to the side, and it actually still drives me crazy every time I see it. even though the school I'm at now, we do that, but when I would see it, I was like, why is this belt, like, move that thing, straighten that thing out? It's driving me crazy. But yeah, when I started at the school that I'm at now, it was like, oh, well, you're gonna have to start over as a white belt. And it was like really? Like, I know snap and twig, I know five swords, but in going through the training, we didn't do at my original school, we didn't do terminology, we didn't do the pledges, we didn't do freestyle. There's a lot of things that we didn't do. And so at this school, But by the time I got to my orange belt, there was so much more knowledge and skill set and understanding that I obtained. And, you know, not knocking my first school, it was great training. A lot of great competitors and stuff came out of the school, and it was great. But it was just a whole different perspective and a whole different set of knowledge that I picked up. And it was like, oh, okay. If I had been allowed to keep my rank, I would have missed out on all of that. So I was very, very fortunate for that. Very fortunate. All right. So we're flying through time here. I mean, there's so many things that I want to get to, but we will, I will try and stay on task here. So, the next little thing here, I recently was involved in a conversation about what it means to be a black belt. And so the kind of conversation was immediately triggered upon a certain person we're not going to talk about in the jiu-jitsu world obtained rank rather quickly. And because there's no standard for what it is to be a black, what it takes to earn a black belt, I decided that I wanted to start asking my guests in your mind, what in your thoughts, experience, what do you think makes a black belt? What does it take to earn a black belt? What does it mean to be a black belt in your mind, your way of thinking?
And that's a fantastic question. When I was first coming up in the arts, I had the idea that every black belt was graded equally and there was an equal standard. And then I went to my black belt test, and there was probably about 100 of us in that organization, varying skill levels, varying abilities, varying levels of understanding. And it shook me a little bit in that moment because I was young. I was 16. And I did go through the art pretty quickly at my age. There wasn't, in the school that I was in, there wasn't really a set lesson plan. You show up and you learn. And I showed up 5 days a week and was super eager. And because of that, I did progress faster than a lot of people did in that time frame. And it made me feel like maybe I hadn't earned my black belt because I saw other people that were struggling and that the standards weren't really set. And so I had a false sense of what that was. In my training and my perspective, being a black belt is the beginning of the understanding of what you've learned up until then. So it's step number one. You've accumulated all these patterns. You've learned all these concepts and principles. You've had all this stuff presented to you. How well do you understand it? How well can you correlate it? And how well can you communicate it and make it happen in real time? And to me, a black belt is not somebody who has gotten all the information and is just understanding it better, but is seeing where the gaps are and continuing to learn. My husband and I just ran a black belt test on Saturday. We run black belt promotions every 4 months. And this time through, one of the things we were focusing on is not only be earning your black belt, what it means to be a black belt. And part of that is finding those knowledge gaps. We do a written test with our students. And the written test is designed for two things. It's designed for us to see what they remember and what they've learned, as well as how we have done as coaches and mentors imparting that information. So it's really a double test. So we see how those things have kind of come together, and where there's gaps along the way, we let them know we're not here to ridicule for what you don't know, but to help you see where those gaps are and fill them. And so it's a learning process. It's teaching them, yes, you know so much and you've come so far and you should be confident. But the cycle needs to be that you're continually learning. You know, like the I Ching, it has a circle and three lines, and the vessel of knowledge, it's always open. If it's not open, you're done learning. If you're done learning, you're stagnant and you're stale and everyone's going to pass you. So it keeps them humble and motivated kind of at the same time.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. There's always so much to learn. And I always kind of have a laugh at those out there that kind of they get their black belt, or they get, you know, fourth degree, fifth degree, whatever. And I'm not just Kenpo, but other styles. But I always kind of laugh at those that kind of have that sense of, oh, well, I'm done, or I've got my cup filled up enough. And okay, maybe there's a few little things that I don't know, but I've got this. And it's like, there's so much, so much. I mean, we in my school, we did a my instructor had us do an exercise of let's take the first technique out of the book, delayed sword. It's like, all right, how much can we do with delayed sword? And like, oh, okay, I don't know, maybe 10, 12. Like, no, like we can go all week, all month, just doing delayed sword and working different angles, different things, different attacks, different combinations, addition. I mean, there's so many things that we can do with just that one technique. I don't see how anyone could say, even train 20, 30, 40 years and be like, I think I'm getting the hang of it. Like, no.
It's impossible to get bored. We had asked Uncle Lethal at one point in time, because he gives us such tremendous insights, and it takes us a while to absorb them and digest them. And he's throwing this fantastic information our way. One day we go, sir, are you still seeing new connections in Kenpo? And he goes, if I wasn't, I would have moved on. And he's been doing this for almost 60 years. And so I'm like, oh, there's Kenpo's like parfait. There's layers. You just got to go look for them. But there are always new things and new connections and new levels of understanding that you can find along the way.
Oh, for sure. For sure. For sure. Oh my goodness. There's so many things that I want to get to. Like I say with all my guests, we'll definitely have to do part 2 and 3 and 4 and 12 and on and on. Yes. And on. But we're going to go ahead and move into what I call our lightning round here. We've got a few little questions as we head towards wrapping up here. So first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
I'll be honest, anything that hits him in the groin. Anything. I'm petite. I got to bring them down to my size. I tell students all the time, my three favorite targets are eyes, throat, and groin. If they can't see me, they can't fight me. If they can't breathe, I have the upper hand. If I kick them in the groin and I'm taller than them, I stand a chance. So anything with the groin strike, bring it on. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, I find my favorite techniques tend to be contact manipulation. I like it when they have their hands on me with grabs, because it gives me the opportunity to use leverage instead of power, which I don't have a lot of mass. I don't have a lot of strength. Leverage is my friend. And for a moment in time, I know where their hands are and I can keep it that way. So contact manipulation techniques, 100%.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Yeah, I'm right there with you doing. So my first teacher, one of his mentors was Professor Wally J, inventor of small circle jiu-jitsu. So we did some really fun stuff with that. And then now doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu and doing Hapkido. I mean, wrist locker all day, baby. So I love wrist locks.
You're speaking my language.
And then another thing that just came to mind, I'm kind of surprised I haven't brought this up in a while. So when I first started doing this show, just kind of organically, the first few guests, I always ended up bringing, kind of dating myself here, but the Panther Production videos. And there was series with David German, and he was doing the Kenpo Jiu-Jitsu connection. And he was applying arm locks and wrist locks and things to Kenpo techniques. And with a number of my first guests, it always seemed to come up like, oh yeah, there was this David German videos. And I succinctly remember him doing one with Flashing Wings and adding in some nice little arm bars and whatnot to the end of Flashing Wings. Was like, oh, like this is great. Like Kenpo is such a great base for all of these different techniques. And now, and when I'm training, and so I was recently at a seminar, and we were working some techniques. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, my old age, I'm thinking about it. Was at a seminar with Mr. Sepulveda, and he was talking about kind of like let's play with the techniques, and let's do some of these kind of. Kenpo is known for beating the crap out of each other, but sometimes we don't need to beat them to a bloody pulp. Sometimes we just need to get their attention, and then we can control them. And so playing around with techniques and adding in arm bars and wrist locks and things to the techniques, and it's like, oh, this is heaven to me. So
it's a beautiful transition. And you know what, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is something that else that my husband and I are pretty passionate about. Last year, we were certified in a what we call locksmith program. It is a PKS program, but it does exactly what you're talking about. It takes Kenpo and shows you the gateway from the Kenpo into joint manipulation, anywhere from wrists, fingers, elbows, shoulders, and it shows you what you can do on the arm, you can then do on the leg. So with the opponent standing, with the opponent on the ground, and it is a phenomenal program put together by Phil Buck. And it takes 16 Kenpo techniques and says, psst, look what you can do. Here's how you can go from, as Mr. Wedley goes, from kicky punchy to bendy twisty and back again. So you can have those two options available. And each technique has six different places where you can branch off to six different locks or positions. And we actually have a group of five of our students that are coming up for certification, oh my goodness, in 2 weeks. Oh, nice. We've been working really hard with them. So you're absolutely right. There is a fantastic gateway between the traditional stand-up Kenpo that we know and those joint manipulations. And for someone of my size, oh, it's my language. I'm not big. I'm not strong. Bring me the leverage. I've got this. And because of that, that locksmith program, it works so well for me.
Excellent. 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 All right. So we're going to move to our next question. What do you have a favorite form and or set?
I have to say form four, all the way form four. It's been one of my favorites from the get-go. Although when I'm emotional and I really just need to Hulk smash, it's the short three. And if I'm really angry, it's the short three twice because it's contact manipulation. You touch me, I hurt you. You touch me, I hurt you. And I don't think there's anything much more empowering than the idea of that they put their hands on you and you've got an answer for them and they're done. And again, you'll see a lot of contact manipulations. It's all grab, chokes, holds, and locks.
Very nice. Very nice. I like it. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite weapon? And even though this is an audio podcast, I will go ahead and comment that on the video here that I'm looking at, I see an assortment, a wall of assortment killing and stabbing and poking devices behind you there. So this may be difficult to limit it to just one, but...
Very difficult. Personal carry would be a Fox knife. Kenpo weapon. I really love the bow staff and the nunchaku. Those are both my favorite. The staff because of Sigang, 100%. And the nunchaku just because it's a ton of fun. And I love that they all relate. It doesn't really matter what weapon you pick up. You use the same patterns. You use a lot of the same concepts, theories, and principles. But yeah, I love every weapon. If you're looking at exotic weapons, the whip chain. I did a personal form with the whip chain, and I did it based off of master key techniques in Kenpo. So that was a really cool experience to figure out how a flailing weapon might be utilized against a self-defense situation and what you might have to alter and change. That was a great experience.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. I like it. All right. Let's see. The next question there. If there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
Ooh. It's a long pause because I'm emotional.
No. Take all the time you need. We got plenty of tape.
Probably not the answer you're looking for. I'd want one more lesson with Sigang. One more class.
I hear you. Unfortunately, I had not had a chance to meet him or train with him or anything like that. But I mean, he's definitely one of the people in the Kenpo world that name just lights people up. And he's definitely someone very, very special. So no, yes. I'm right there with you.
Yep. They're all chopped liver compared to him. There, I said it.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. Our final question here is, what is something that always motivates you to train? So I use the example of the movie Rocky IV when he's chopping the wood, running in the snow, lifting the boulders, and that music's going. I see that scene and I'm hitting the mats, I'm hitting the bags, I'm fired up, I'm ready to go. So what is something like that for you that just always gets you out there on the mats and ready to train?
It's going to come back to that not me, not today. Just having that feeling of knowing nothing can hurt me again. Nothing. And every time I train, I have that empowered feeling I love elbows. I call them my blender blades. If you put your hand in my blender, it's your fault. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter how small those blades are. I'm going to make a bad guy smoothie. That's what I tell my kids. And so it's just that feeling of whenever I feel like I'm maybe not empowered or I'm not confident or I'm unsure of myself, I get out on the mats. I hit the bag. I run the three. I do something physical. And it reminds me of my self-worth. And it reminds me what I'm capable of. And it keeps me in a positive place, which is not what I'm built from, but it's where I want to be.
Very nice. Very nice. I like that. All right. So we are now at our final piece of our time today. And that is a shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything that you want, or if there's anything that we hadn't covered that you wanted to make sure that you get out there, you have the floor, and then we'll close out from there.
Wonderful. I'll start with, we have a big event coming up in December. This is actually our 20th anniversary of running a workshop and awards banquet to celebrate our students. It's the first weekend in December. We have 10 instructors coming out. Mr. Sepulveda would have made it, but he had a back surgery that he's recovering very well from, and we're cheering him on. But we have Lee Wedlake. We have two of Mr. Sepulveda's students, the Donatios, in his place. We have Barbara White and some of her students coming out. And then we have Phil Buck, the locksmith, coming in from England. So it's an event we do every year. It's Christmas early. We're really excited. I also want to give a shout out to our school that just celebrated its 24th year in September in this location, in this plaza. We bought the building 9 years ago, so we shifted locations, but it was a huge upgrade. And then always want to give a shout out to my husband. I know this podcast is not about him, but I wouldn't be the martial artist that I am if it weren't for him. In 2019, we were both incredibly fortunate that Bob White inducted him into the Masters Hall of Fame and had me included in the Journey Book 3. So if I mention one, I'm going to mention the other, because those two go hand in hand, and we're grateful for that opportunity.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah. When we do our part 25, we definitely need to talk about the Journey books. Amy Long was one of my previous guests, actually one of my early guests, one of the first, I don't know, first 5 or 10 guests. So yeah, we definitely have to talk about that next time. But yeah, I thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your story. And I mean, we could definitely talk Kenpo five days straight and still have lots to go on. But
for sure.
You of course have a open invitation to be on any time. So I hope that you will come back and we'll get into more fun things. But once again, I thank you so much for being on, and I can't wait to get this out to share with the listeners. And we'll have to do this again.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for the service that you're doing, getting this information out and sharing the martial arts passion with other people. I really appreciate that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.